for biological organs possessed by roughly half the human population, it's kind of stunning how little we know about the vagina and its adjacent parts. Medical science has solved a lot of the mysteries around how babies are conceived, gestated, and born, but really those are just short-term special events in a typical lifespan. What about the many decades bodies are not pregnant? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Rachel E. Gross is a science journalist who realized a few years ago how little she knew about her own body, how it worked, and what it needed to stay healthy. She wasn't somehow uniquely ignorant. She discovered that for millennia, scientists just didn't pay a lot of attention to the specific properties of female bodies, and what we don't know can hurt us. Rachel E. Gross's new book is called Vagina Obscura, An Anatomical Voyage. Rachel, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm thrilled to have you. I will remind folks, we just told you what this show is going to be about. If it's something you're uncomfortable listening to with kids around, just want to make that note to you. So this project started for you when you developed an infection. You were prescribed what amounted to rat poison, which I guess was supposed to be used as a suppository in the middle of the night. You sleepily ingested it as a pill. Why was this the moment when you realized you did not know enough about the way a human vagina works?
Yep, that's the summary. Right. So, I mean, this didn't come out of nowhere. At the time, I was the science editor at Smithsonian.com, and I was producing a lot of stories that were on reproductive biology and animal sex, and also women in the history of science. So a lot of these themes were floating in my head, especially about who in history gets to ask the questions about human bodies and who doesn't, and how that shapes the science that comes out of that process. And then in the middle of that, yes, I got a bacterial infection that wouldn't go away and was prescribed something that my gynecologist told me was rat poison. And she said, I was going to find that out on the internet anyway, so she might as well tell me now. And this has been used since the 1800s. It's like an antiseptic, and it's called boric acid. And what's really stunning is that even she admitted this didn't help that many women. Really, this infection can come back again and again, and we really don't have a good solution for it, even though it affects 1 in 3 people before menopause. So, like, that was just kind of a wild, like, kind of confrontation with how little we know for me.
Right. Like, why aren't there more options than this?
Right. Why haven't we concerned ourselves with innovating beyond rat poison?
This blew my mind. It wasn't until 1993 that federally funded health research was required to even include the bodies of women and people of color.
Yeah, that's right. So there were these longstanding kind of concerns about women, for instance, being in clinical trials. So the idea that women menstruate was thought to mess up the data. There's concerns about having pregnant women in trials. And there was also just this kind of assumption that's been with us for a very long time that the white male is the default body. And so you don't need to include other types of people.
Before 1993, when medical research did focus on women, the point was often understanding fertility, but even those of us who will bear children, like, spend the vast majority of our lives not pregnant.
Right. That's exactly the big takeaway that I was getting as I was looking into all these organs, which I sometimes call, like, the vagina et al. Or the vagina and colleagues.
Colleagues, I like that.
Colleagues, they work together collegiately. So it was kind of stunning to me that, right, every time you see a uterus in an old anatomical textbook, it's usually pregnant and it's usually giving you information about childbirth. But we have these organs with us our entire lives, and they're not just sitting around doing nothing. So I was interested in finding out what they were doing the rest of our very long non-pregnant lives. And I found out quite a lot.
Speaking of pregnancy, by the way, what do we know about how and when fetuses of different sexes differentiate so that we can tell them apart?
Right. So about 6 weeks in the womb, all fetuses are pretty much identical. They have this thing, it's like a little nub between the legs called the genital tubercle, and it can go either way, it can evolve into a clitoris or a penis. It kind of has this potential to go anywhere. At the same time, you have these two sets of plumbing. You have sort of the proto, like ovaries and fallopian tubes, and the proto testes and sperm ducts. And the way that science often tells the story is that at a certain point, a decision is reached and one set of tubes withers away, and this nub either becomes a clitoris or a penis. But it's often described as sort of that the female is the default path, like the default iPhone setting, and the testes and penis is like the bells and whistles. That's like you need this active genetic factor on the Y chromosome to make this process happen. And we now know that's very likely not the case. There are also active genetic factors that code for ovarian development. Ovaries don't just form out of nowhere as a default. And so the idea that we're all sort of born female, or all, sorry, female in the womb, which some people like to say, I don't think that's quite correct. I think of it more as we have this universal body plan, and there are many pathways that branch off of that, but essentially we're working with all the same parts. And that's especially clear when you look at the anatomy of the clitoris and the penis. The clitoris is not just like a nub that you can see and touch. That's actually the equivalent of the head of the penis. That's the glans clitoris. And behind that, you have a shaft that flares back into two bulbs that hug the vagina and two arms that sort of flare into the pubis. So that, and it's all made of the same erectile tissue that's found in the penis. So in a way, we don't ever fully diverge. We're working with all the same components, and there's a really a lot of overlapping anatomy and a lot more similarities than differences.
But for a long time, the assumption was that the bodies of women were essentially precisely like the bodies of men turned inside out. What were the long-term ramifications of that sort of thinking?
Yeah, that was one big theme. So even into the 1600s, when I was looking at like Italian anatomists, they would illustrate what they said was a uterus, but it was clearly like an interior penis with the ovaries as testicles. And it's very strange that they were seeing with their eyes the same human bodies that scientists today are, but that's how they were viewing it. How does it affect how bodies are treated today? I think it led to a lot of ignoring of structures and some of the unique biology and really cool stuff that the uterus and ovaries are doing. I think maybe one example is that until the 1600s, the ovaries were just called female testicles. Nobody bothered to find out what they really did. They were thought to maybe release something called female sperm or maybe just be vestigial organs. But nobody really looked at them and found out like their contribution of eggs to conception and also of producing hormones, which supports every body system.
And for a very, very, very long time, the assumption, I guess, was that if the penis was the locus of sexual pleasure for men, therefore the vagina must be it for women. Is that right?
Yes, and I think we can all blame Freud for that. I mean, not just him, but he really doubled down on this idea that the vagina was sort of the proper center of female pleasure and that mature women felt pleasure and had orgasms in their vaginas, which turned out to be biologically impossible and untrue. And he kind of dismissed the clitoris and said that it was an infantile organ and that women that wanted to have a clitoral orgasm were kind of unable to let go of their phallus and dream of being a man.
Oh, Freud.
I know, I can't believe I'm repeating this. I did not expect Freud to have such a big role in this book, which was really about anatomical science and the history of medicine, but it turned out he had such a big effect on those things that I had to go into his story.
At one point, he compared the clitoris to pine shavings. You have to explain this.
Yeah, I know. Let's see if I can. He thought that when a woman is a young girl, then she will masturbate using her clitoris. But the only point of this is that the clitoris is like pine shavings that gets the fire going where it's supposed to be. So, like on the pile of wood, which I guess is the vagina. So, he wanted people to transfer their orgasm from their clitoris to their vagina, which I cannot stress enough is impossible.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the 16th century, because there was this anatomist named Matteo Real de Colombo who claimed to have discovered the clitoris, which is a statement at least as ridiculous as Christopher Columbus claiming to have discovered this like continent full of advanced civilizations. But it wasn't that nobody knew it was there before, right? What had the prevailing medical wisdom been before Matteo Real de Colombo came along?
So there are actually a lot of different notions about the clitoris. Like Aristotle noted that there was something he called a little pillar that might be erectile, and the word comes up before, but nobody really like codifies it in the medical literature or figures out exactly what it's for. And Colombo, like, besides just claiming that he had discovered the clitoris, also kind of ascribes it a sexual pleasure function. And that is sort of considered new in his time. So at the time, you had Vesalius, who was kind of considered the father of modern anatomy, saying that the clitoris only exists in hermaphrodites, and kind of denying all of his colleagues that say, actually, we found this structure that seems pretty obvious and clearly it's important. So there was kind of a clitoral cat fight going on, and Colombo was on the side of it exists. And because he thought he had discovered it, he thought that he should have the right to name it. And he said that if anyone else claims they had discovered it, then they are definitely lying, or they learned it from me and my students.
We have to assume, right, that plenty of people knew exactly what it was and what it was good for before Colombo came along.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, I don't know if he talked to any women or people with clitorises. It seems not.
All right. So I will say, if there's a takeaway from this show, it's that the actual structure of the clitoris is 10 times the size of the visible structure outside the body. And we have Helen O'Connell to thank for that.
Yeah, that's right. So Helen really, she's a urologist, the first female urologist in Australia, and she describes the clitoris as an iceberg organ. I think that image has been really useful for people to understand what's going on there. So again, picture like the head of the penis, or like a tiny tip of a pyramid above sand. There's this whole internal kingdom that really stretches deep into the pelvis behind that. And it's all involved in sexual experience and pleasure. And it probably has something to do with the misconception that there's such a thing as a vaginal orgasm, because in reality, the clitoris really encircles the vagina and the urethra, and it's really involved in all the sensation that you have down there.
So why did it take so long for anyone to figure this out?
I think, again, it's important to know that anatomists did look at these structures earlier. So you have George Cobelt, a German anatomist in the 1800s, who does these beautiful ink paintings or drawings of the clitoris, where he shows all this erectile tissue. And they know what's going on, but for some reason, it doesn't catch on in the mainstream. And that knowledge does not get passed down and codified in textbooks. So it's really like a rediscovery process every time. And Helen O'Connell, I think, did an especially good job with that, because she brought to bear all of these modern tools, did these thorough dissections, and really made this case for what this organ looks like.
So you talk here about FGM. It can be really hard to hear stories about female genital mutilation and understand why anybody would subject a child to this. What is the purpose of this ritual cutting in places where it's still practiced?
So first of all, I would use the term female genital cutting. I talked to a lot of scholars, and they made a really good argument that having that M in the word mutilation can be really ethnocentric. Hmm. And a lot of women don't like it and find that it's stigmatizing. And it kind of just shows the location we're talking from. So I think I'm not the person to speak to why this is practiced across many cultures and countries. But what I can say, and what I do go into in the book, is that I think it's important to recognize that genital cutting has been done in Western societies for a very long time. And it's a really organic part of Western culture. So I trace Isaac Baker Brown, a British surgeon in the 1800s, who kind of spread the idea that a cure for masturbation in young girls was surgically removing the clitoris. And even after he was sort of shooed out of his authority by other doctors, that idea traveled to America and was championed by people like James Harvey Kellogg, so John Harvey Kellogg, literally the cornflakes giant, who thought you should put carbolic acid on children who were masturbating, or that you should remove the clitoris. So I think this isn't talked about as much, and I think we really lose a lot of insight and perspective when we relegate these practices to, quote, other cultures.
But nobody was putting carbolic acid on the penises of boys who were caught masturbating.
They actually were.
Were
Um,
they?
so
Wow.
he recommended it for both. But as far as I can see, the kind of trying to amputate the clitoris was that was like, well, obviously a female thing. No one was amputating a penis, so no one was going that far.
So doctors now are looking to potentially repair the damage done to women who are cut against their will.
Right. So I go into the surgeons who are developing these techniques, and they do call it reconstruction. And the basic idea is pretty simple. So we talked about how much erectile tissue is beneath the surface, and how less than 10% is in what many people think of the clitoris, which is kind of the nub. So if you can pull up and expose some of that tissue beneath, the idea is that you might be able to regain some sensory function and have kind of an exposed clitoris again. And I was interested in this in the book because I was trying to show the thread of how innovations in anatomical knowledge trickle down to people's lived lives, how they affect women and people with this anatomy who are interacting with the medical system, how it affects their options, their treatment, and how medicine views them. And this was one way in which it was pretty clear that understanding the shape of the clitoris was a foundation of these kind of techniques and also gender affirmation surgeries. So it was not to say that these surgeries, like exactly what their outcomes are, because that is still definitely under dispute.
So, why have scientists, or why did scientists assume for so long that female bodies were sort of passive recipients for sperm rather than active participants in reproduction? We're not talking about the social aspects of this. We're talking about just about the physiological aspect.
I think that you can't disentangle those two things. I mean, you could try, but really a big theme of my book is that science is always a social enterprise. It's always done in the cultural muck of whatever era you're in, and you have to take into consideration those scientists' biases and attitudes. So your question makes me think of Darwin, and I think it's fairly well known that his idea of evolution came about in a very Victorian English society when there actually was a move towards suffrage and women's rights, but there was also a big conservative backlash that he was sort of part of. He was kind of anti-birth control. I don't think he had great views on women's suffrage either. So consider that he was one of the big figures who described the female as the more passive, chaste, monogamous, and just like less intelligent and less interesting half of the equation. And he said this straight out about humans and non-human animals. And there's like some shocking quotes that are just like, in, power, strength, and intelligence, the male is always better equipped. And this is because he has this competition to get the female and he has to win her over with his wiles and his strength. So I don't see how we can separate those conclusions, which then became considered scientific fact at the time, from the cultural milieu.
The result of this is that most of science concerned itself with penis structure rather than vagina structure when looking at reproduction across the animal kingdom. Tell us how some kind of much misunderstood research on ducks helped to set things straight.
Yes, I think a lot of people encountered the duck penis through a series of memes and YouTube videos a few years back, and they basically learned that ducks have these really crazy looking long coiled penises, and they're kind of scary, and they're very aggressive. And that was sort of the conversation. Well, it turns out there was another half of the conversation, and that was duck vaginas. And I ended up following a scientist named Patty Brennan, who was one of the first people to ask, like, okay, we're getting riled up over these crazy duck penises and what they mean for sexual behavior and sexual evolution. Has anyone looked at the female? And pretty much no one had.
Wow.
yeah, I couldn't believe it. And I called up all of the male scientists who wrote about these duck penises, and they were like, honestly, it's really fitting that she did it. Probably a man shouldn't have done this. I was like, that's one way to think about it, but someone should have. So she did these kind of intricate, laborious dissections of duck vaginas and found that, as you might guess, they are equally complex, kind of strategic structures that I think she described as labyrinths with like blind end ways. And they kind of allow a female duck to control the paternity of her offspring in some way. Not that she is aware of this necessarily, but they're as evolutionarily important and interesting. And I think most importantly, they're working together with the male side. So if you only study males, you're listening to like half of a conversation, like our interview right now. And that does not help you conclude much. It's very unhelpful for science. So she kind of dedicated her work to leveling the playing field. And she's now investigating the female genitalia of a whole variety of different species, like mammals, lizards, dolphins, which have very well developed clitorises, and more.
Who was Miriam Menken?
Miriam Menken was a really brilliant Boston scientist during World War II, and she was the first person to fertilize an egg in vitro outside the body. So she really helped lay the foundation for modern IVF and other reproductive technologies. But very few people know her name.
Why has she been forgotten?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if she was ever that well known in the first place, but she was a technician with John Rock, who is famous for many reasons, including being part of the development of the birth control pill. And she was able to make this discovery while she was a mother of two, including a baby. And she was working after midnight at this charity hospital in Brookline in Boston. And she was sort of facing all the problems that women in science did at her time. So she was unable to get a PhD at the time, most medical, or rather a medical degree, because most medical schools did not accept women or only accepted a few as exceptions. And she instead got a secretary degree. She was helping to support her husband, who was working at Harvard. And right after she made this huge discovery, he lost his job and was forced to go to South Carolina. So she basically had to follow him. And that derailed her career, among other things.
We're learning now that gut bacteria play like this enormous role in overall health, far beyond the digestive system. What sort of microbial contents are characteristic of a healthy vagina?
Yeah, I like to say a healthy vagina is like a garden or a rainforest. It's really got a mixture of things. There are bacteria, viruses, sometimes fungi, and all that is totally fine, just like it's fine to have a few weeds or different species in a garden. It's about the overall balance. So what they're finding is that most healthy vaginas are dominated by forms of this bacteria called lactobacillus, and they kind of look like good and plenty candies, like little rods. And what's unique about them is that they spew out a weak acid and they keep the acidity of the vagina fairly high, about the pH of a glass of red wine. And that really helps protect it against unwanted visitors and disruptions to the environment, which there are many that it's contending with, including tampons and birth control and penises and semen. So it's really this dynamic shifting ecosystem down there.
So a dynamic and complex microbial mix suggests plenty can also go wrong. For a long time, a lot of scientists thought this was kind of an unimportant place to focus their research careers, I guess.
I would argue that a lot still do. Yeah, I was really, so I met scientists who are doing these innovative trials, and they're saying that there are women who have recurrent bacterial infections and other issues with their microbiome. So similar to what I experienced and what I mentioned at the intro of the book, and there's no good solution. What if we try kind of like terraforming the vagina, including even transplanting one vaginal microbiome to another? And we know it worked with feces. It worked for the gut microbiome. So why not try it here? Like, yes, it definitely needs a lot of safety checks. It's definitely a higher risk thing to do, but it's a first step in understanding how to reliably shift this ecosystem towards health. And the researchers leading that work were telling me that it's really hard to get funding and buy-in. And when they approach funders and startups, often people will kind of be disgusted and turn away from them. And what they think is going on is that there's two levels of ick. So with fecal transplants, there's, okay, gross poop, but we need to try desperate measures because we have infections that kill people. And so we're willing to do a fecal transplant. And with vaginas, there's like ick vaginas, which I do not condone. And then there's, well, it's just vagina problems. That's normal. So people don't take it seriously enough to innovate and put resources into this problem in the same way.
Where does endometriosis fit into that, which is this really painful disease for folks who don't know that causes like uterine lining tissue to grow where it doesn't belong? Do they have to go the route of looking at the ways it might interfere with pregnancy to get funded?
Right. That's a great example. Right. So endometriosis is when cells similar to that of the uterine lining do spread outside of the pelvis. Often they can get to the ovaries, sometimes even the lungs and the brain. And it's very painful because that lining is trying to grow and shed and bleed every month. And it is associated with infertility, interestingly, but for so many people, that is not their main concern at all. Their main concern is how debilitating it is to their life. And yet they're given crazy advice sometimes by doctors, including like, maybe you should get pregnant because that's thought to help the disease. And I talked to people who had been given that advice and was shocked. So endometriosis has been super lesser known and underfunded for a very long time. And I think, yes, many researchers did make the argument that this is about infertility, but not as successfully. But the bioengineer I talked to in the book, Linda Griffith at MIT, she actually came from a different field than women's health. She came from bioengineering. So she was kind of sculpting organs out of living cells. And she makes a very different argument that I think is super interesting. She says the uterus is not just dynamic and fascinating when it's making a baby. It's actually one of the most regenerative organs in the body. Every month, it's remaking itself. It's growing a totally new lining out of these cells called decidual cells that then shed like deciduous leaves of a tree. It grows new blood vessels, which again are just, they're orchestrated by this complex hormonal dance to all fall off at the same time. And then it rebuilds itself with no scarring, no wound. So this is biologically interesting far beyond the bodies of people with uteruses and those with endometriosis. Really, if we study how things go wrong in this process, and if we better understand the science of menstruation, we're probably going to unlock all these biological secrets about immunity and wound healing and regeneration as well. So she kind of takes it broader than that to make the argument for funding.
The standard story about ovaries is that a baby is born with all the egg cells they will ever have. What sort of information is emerging that might call that into question?
Yeah, so for actually almost 20 years, there have been some studies challenging this truism, which it's kind of this wondrous scientific fact, like, oh, a female baby floating in the womb has all of her eggs inside of her and her mother has her inside of her. That's three generations, which is super cool.
I love thinking about that, actually. Yeah.
Me too. Like, to me, that actually evokes a lot of awe and wonder, which is something I'm really interested in as a science writer. But then I come across this research that suggests maybe that's not the whole story. So some biologists have been finding evidence that ovaries have stem cells that are capable of becoming new eggs. And we don't know for sure what they're doing in the human body. That's harder to study, but there's definitely now, kind of a trail of scientific papers finding that this is probably the case in many non-human animals like mice and zebrafish, and there's evidence that it could be happening in women as well. And it's still kind of controversial and very attacked, but it would really change how we think about reproductive technologies and possibly how we think about menopause.
Did working on this book change the way you feel about your own body?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I too had a lot of these assumptions. Like, I definitely was like, okay, it's my reproductive system. It's there in case I want to have a baby, which, like, I don't really right now, but glad it's waiting in the wings. And now I think of something like my ovaries, which I did view as a biological clock. And now I'm thinking of them as this, like, battery that's powering my whole body, that's supporting my bone health, my cognitive health, my heart health, and constantly producing these hormones that are just traveling everywhere and are not just important for making a baby or for my genitals. I think of the reproductive system or reproductive sexual system as being deeply intertwined with our entire bodies and a really like fundamental part of keeping our body's health supported and in balance.
Science journalist Rachel E. Gross is author of Vagina Obscura, An Anatomical Voyage. Rachel, this has been really interesting. Thanks for spending this time with us.
It was great. Thank you so much for these very thoughtful questions and to the listeners who called in.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. Do subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcast by searching for KERA Think and then signing up. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.